Once again, it's a great pleasure to be in front of, actually, some of my mentors actually are here, so now I'm even more scared to give this talk, but I guess that's what the nature of the game is. So today, yes, I'm going to talk about a new speculative connection between neutrino oscillations and dark energy, whatever that is. But I'm going to make a slightly bold claim today, and which is that in order to get neutrino oscillations, I will have to claim what dark energy actually is. And I'm just going to tell you straightforwardly what it is. It's on cosmological scales, according to this mechanism, there are going to be strong correlations that put neutrinos, the good old-fashioned neutrinos that we know and love, in a BCS-like condensate. That BCS condensate was actually established in the early universe, and I'm going to make arguments as to why it's still stable today. But once neutrinos propagate in that condensate, it unnaturally will undergo oscillations of the same order of magnitude as a dark energy condensate. And I'm going to show how this model evades the problems of instability that the original MAVEN models have. So that's the basic idea. And now the rest of the talk is to convince you of that. But the reason why I actually like this idea is because it actually has a prediction. It actually has a prediction. We'll end with that prediction. But it also has some problems that maybe some of you can exploit. All right. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the dark energy and the cosmological constant problem in the context of neutrino oscillations. Please excuse my voice. I just got over H2N2 virus. And don't worry, I'm not infectious anymore. Thank you. And then I'm going to review BCS superconductivity in the context of cosmology. And what I mean by that is that I'm actually going to show you some of the details of the calculations that we developed, me and my postdocs down at Penn State developed. And we hope that the effective field theory is as best defined as we could possibly do it. And so we're going to talk about superconductivity in the context of cosmology. And the real upshot here was going way back to the days when Lee and I were at Imperial. We always dreamt of trying to do cosmology without fundamental scalar fields, and this is an attempt to do that. And then I'm going to talk about the details of the mechanism, meaning that, what do the modified Friedman equations do for us? We'll find that you get a natural singularity resolution in this model, a non-singular bounce, rather. And then I'm going to go now into how this model actually naturally gives you neutrino oscillations. And I'm going to talk about what the assumptions are here for the standard model. Okay? And then I'm going to conclude with what I consider the prediction. So many of this is review for many of us, which is we can look at the redshift distance relationship, the luminosity relationship of supernova. I'm quoting results from Rice and Perlmutter. That we, most of the community, I think, agrees now that the universe is indeed accelerating. And if we don't do much to our standard cosmological scenario, in other words, if we don't introduce voids, I know you like voids, and I wrote a paper about it as well, but I'm putting on my dark energy hat today. So even with voids, it's very hard to reproduce the confluence of all of the cosmological data. So yes, there is some substance out there that is homogeneous, isotropic, and it has the same properties everywhere, and it's making the universe accelerate. We just don't know what it is. Now, if it's not evolving, it's a cosmological constant. If it is evolving, then it's anybody's game. And there are lots of models to try to accommodate this dark energy. Well, these models fall into two classes. you introduce some sort of substance. Most of these models tend to be some fundamental scalar field. Or you can modify gravity in the infrared. I am not going to talk about either. I'm going to talk about quintessence a little bit. So we can ask, what is the culprit? Given the time, and given that I want to spend more time on sort of going through the technical details of my work here, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about other people's work, because that's actually some of your work here, and you know it better than me. But the question really is, if dark energy is here, and it's a substance, and it's not a modification of general relativity, what is it? What is it? I'm not going to talk about why the cosmos, why vacuum energy is real, but I want to talk about quintessence. So these are the culprits behind the idea of a fundamental scalar field that could make the universe expand today. And it's actually a good idea. I actually like this idea. So the basic idea is that you have some classically minimally coupled scalar field, and it evolves by some tracking potential such that at late times you get the domination, dark energy domination. But, you know, it's still, like good old-fashioned scalar field theory, suffers from, you know, why does this field evolve exactly today to have the VEV that it has? And the other question you can ask is, you know, why is, you know, if the energy scale of this scalar field today is merely electron volt scale, and you would expect it's a classical potential, why don't quantum corrections spoil that, the flatness of that potential? Of course, I mean, there are supersymmetric models of this, or where you can have some flat potential that's protected by a global symmetry, and those models are fine, all right? But you still have to deal with this problem. And I'm going to present a model to you today that actually deals better with these two ideas, okay? But I'm going to carry over some of the ideas from quintessence. So what I'm doing, I'm using the same physical ideas of quintessence, but I'm going to try to reconstruct the quintessence field from degrees of freedom that already do exist in nature. Okay? These degrees of freedom are Dirac fermions. And then later on, I'm going to actually tell you where in the standard model we will find, you know, what fermions these things are if you want to get neutrino oscillations. So I agree that quintessence does get the job done. And what we want to do is alleviate some of the problems of quintessence, or given the late time acceleration.
But lambda does that.
Lambda, but an evolving late time acceleration.
So you want an evolving.
I want to do quintessence all over again, but now without a fundamental scalar field. So, can the quintessence field emerge from matter fields? That's a question you want to answer. And if I do this, do I solve some of the problems of quintessence, the problems that I told you before? And the answer is yes. But now let's move on to neutrinos. So I talked about, very quickly, the dark energy problem and dark energy versus a cosmological constant. And I'm putting my cards on the table. I'm saying I want to talk about involving cosmological constant here and trying to improve on that. What about neutrinos? Well, we observed that neutrinos are oscillating. And this tells us that if indeed neutrinos are massive, then the mass eigenstates and the flavor eigenstates, because of the interaction with the mass of Z and W, are not the same, and they're related to each other by a unitary transformation, a flavor transformation, in this manner. And if I diagonalize this matrix, I pick up these three phases that two of which are measured. So the idea is that there's also a mass hierarchy in neutrino, in a neutrino mass matrix, and that leads basically to the different hierarchies of neutrino flavors. Okay, and the name of the game is to measure these by looking at neutrino oscillations. And what I just want to do is report, at least to what I know, what the latest, maybe some people know that there are better bounds, but Snow and Kamlin experiment have established theta 1-2 solar neutrinos to oscillate, have an oscillation phase delta m, which is the difference between, in this case, an electron and a muon neutrino and the masses, to be in the order of 10 to the minus 5 electron volts. This number is smaller than this number because of the so-called MSW effect. Neutrinos propagating through the sun interacts with the electron background, and that will reduce the delta M squared. And atmospheric neutrinos, theta 2 to 3 has been measured to be 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. And so some of our colleagues, going way back to Fardon, Weiner, and Nelson, took this sort of coincidence seriously, that if you look at the coupling of the Higgs to some heavy neutrino state, for example, this is the so-called seesaw mechanism, you can naturally get a VeV that's 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 electron volts for the neutrino mass. Okay? And you can do the same thing and realize that the mass of the quintessence field is of the same order. And so our colleagues realized that what if there is some deep connection between neutrinos and dark energy because of the coincidence of scales here. And so what they just did was they had a Yukawa coupling, and they coupled what they call the acceleron field to the neutrino number density. And they were able to get a connection between how the equation of state parameter evolves and how the neutrino oscillation evolves. Okay? And it was a remarkable result. And then some bad guy here in the room and his friend Zaldiriaga wrote a paper, and they actually said, okay, let's take this cosmology very seriously. Let's perturb this fluid. Let's perturb this dark energy with this interaction present. And they found imaginary speed of sound for linear perturbations. So that scenario generically is unstable. What I'm going to do today is something very similar, and then we can ask the same question, whether or not this thing is unstable or not. But what I'm going to do is try to do the same thing. I'm going to look for a connection. And the question I'm going to ask is, does the scale of dark energy and neutrinos emerge from the same underlying physics? And on Monday, there's a paper coming online that I just put out yesterday that I've been working on over the last 2 years. And actually, a big part of this talk is that paper. So we're going to seek a new path. Now let's get into Michael.
In the previous slide. So the fact that the leading term in the potential is m neutrino squared, is that natural? That comes from the Majorana mass?
Yeah, in that case, they have a Majorana coupling.
Okay.
And that's right.
And you're also going to have a Majorana?
No.
Oh, okay.
I only have the rock neutrinos. Let me say straightforward what I'm doing.
So this is going to be a problem for you. To get M5 to be not linear at mu, but squared at mu?
Yes. There's going to be a natural Yukawa coupling.
Sorry, that's not what I asked.
Okay.
M5 proportional to mu squared.
Yes.
Is that going to be natural?
It's going to be natural.
Okay. We'll see.
Yes. We'll see. We'll see. Just like the good old days. Okay. So let me just lay out the context I'm working in. I'm working in a good old-fashioned standard model where neutrinos are completely massive. There's no coupling to the Higgs whatsoever. And I'm going to try to get their masses in a different way. No seesaw mechanism. I'm sorry. No coupling to the Higgs at all.
But the neutrino mass is SU2 cross U1 by.
I'm setting all the Higgs coupling to zero to the neutrinos.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So let me just tell you what the idea here is. I'm not going to use a scalar field. I'm going to use the fermions that we have. And in fact, I'm going to show you that it's actually natural from the context of general relativity. So general relativity gets modified in a way to accommodate fermions naturally. And it's based on some work that Laurent had done in the past and amongst other people. So the basic idea is that condensates are nice because if you look at, you know, a typical superconductor, when you look in the infrared at large distance scales, the condensate actually can vanish, okay? The reason why that happens is in the infrared, the gap with the order parameter gets exponentially suppressed, okay? So the amplitude of the gap goes as e to the 1 over the coupling constant divided times the density of states. And so, but in the perturbative regime of that gap, the amplitude is actually higher. So I can imagine a scenario where in the early universe, oh no, oh, I should plug this thing in. No, we don't want it. No. Okay. So also condensates typically can be long-range quantum phenomena. So you can have a macroscopic quantum state, like a neutron star, a good example. Of course, we're going to make these things macroscopic quantum states, but the Broglie wavelength is in the order of the horizon. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm going to show you it could happen. And, you know, we see them. They're ubiquitous. I mean, these things are common all across nature. So why not apply it to cosmology and see what happens? And the condensates we're going to talk about today are fermionic condensates. Okay? And the basic idea here, the analogy I'm going to use here, is the following. This should be more like a superfluid, like helium-3. Okay? So I don't want to talk about metal, because the universe is not a metal, right? And the universe is not a lattice unless you believe in some fundamental lattice at the Planck scale. But in superfluid helium-3, the helium-3 atoms can be treated as fermions, and the helium-3 gas can have a 4-fermion interaction. They can have strong correlations about their Fermi surface. And they can condense via something called the Cooper instability, which says that if I have a Fermi surface, I can have correlations between fermions of equal and opposite spin and momenta across a Fermi surface. This is a Fermi sphere, and this is a Fermi surface. And if you have a degeneracy in the energy spectrum of these fermions, these correlations become relevant operators. And this scattering is a 4-point scattering. So you have a 4-fermion term, and it has to be attractive. And no matter how weak it is, if the system is at finite density, you will get an instability. What did I mean by that? I basically mean that if I solve the energy eigenvalue problem with this 4-fermion term and a many-body wave function, the true ground state, or in other words, there's another ground state where the eigen values correspond to pairs of those fermions. And what BCS was able to show was that if you did a variational principle, you found that the ground state energy of that system is lower than the free propagating fermions. Okay? So what happens is that's a true vacuum in the theory, and the conduction electrons is basically unstable to the true vacuum where you have Cooper pairs or pairs of in other words, these fermions condense into bosons, bosonic degrees of freedom. That's a basic idea. And there are many ways to realize this. You can do this canonically, you can do this with a Hamiltonian, or you can do it relativistically with the Lagrangian formalism. And we did both, actually. So there's an earlier paper. In fact, years ago, John and I started looking at this. And then when I got to Penn State, we wanted to do it even more rigorously. So we actually did it that way. And this work, we're going to do it using the path integral language. And this was something I learned actually from Michael and BJ Bjorken when I was at Slack. So thank you very much. Okay. So just to recapitulate, the idea here is that you have this unstable background. So So in superconductivity, I have a Fermi surface, I have fermions at finite number density, and the perturbative states, those free electrons in this case, they're unstable to form in a Cooper pair, and that is characterized by an energy gap. And this energy gap in the infrared goes as 1 over the density of states times a coupling. So it's a non-perturbative effect, because if G goes to 0, this becomes singular. You can't really get it from perturbation theory. And so you have this gap and you have this true ground state. And this also plays a role as a fermion bilinear, the vacuum expectation value of the fermion bilinear. Okay? So in our model, this gap will play the role of the quintessence field. So if I carry this language over to gravity, what I'm going to show you now is that this mechanism can be naturally encoded in general relativity after I make a few assumptions. How does this happen? Well, there's a perturbative vacuum. I have my fermions in the early universe. I look at fluctuations of the background space-time. Yes?
Fermi energy? Are you going to tell us that later?
Yes, the Fermi, the Fermi energy related to the chemical potential.
Okay.
And that is the input, that is the assumption.
And what's the value going to turn out to be in space universe?
It's going to be the scale of dark energy.
10^-3
It's exactly 10^-3 eV. The gap equation becomes self-consistently solved at that value.
Okay,
so that's a coincidence.
So that's larger than, but not by much, the current microwave background.
That's fine. That's on the order for also 10^3.
The criterion for this to work is that that number has to be larger than the microwave background.
Yes. And the neutrino number density is 1 electron. What is it?
3 Kelvin.
1 Kelvin. 1
yeah,
out
yeah, that's the point.
Yeah. Good. All right. So the point here is that does general relativity, when I include fermions at finite number density, does the theory actually have this instability built in? And I'm going to argue, that it does under one condition. So here's my picture. Here's my universe. It's filled with fermions, and that's supposed to mean fermions. Okay. Now I stole this from. I was trying to find a picture on Google, and you know, to sort of give me an artist's impression of this thing. And this was the best I was able to find. So this is from some unknown person on. So this is from some unknown person in Google. All right, so it's, but the basic picture, we have the early universe is very dark, and I have fermions all over the place, and gravity naturally will create this. So let's show, yeah.
So these don't know.
Okay. So now let's go into some equations. And so I hope everyone gets the basic picture, but sometimes it gets clearer once I show some equations. The basic assumption I'm going to make here is the following. I am going to work in the first order formalism of general relativity, because to couple fermions to general relativity properly, I need to use the Veerbein field. Okay? And that will become clear in the next thing. So what I'm going to do is take all my Dirac fermions in the standard model and couple it covariantly to general relativity. And this, my covariant derivative here, includes the full SO31 connection. Yeah.
Thank you. So the Fermi energy is going to be of order 10 to the minus 3 eV.
Yes, today.
The gap is going to be 10 to the minus 3 eV times some e to the minus 1 over g squared term?
No.
The gap is exponentially suppressed with respect to the Fermi.
Wait, one second. Well, let's look at the equations. I'll have the equation, the gap equation.
Okay. So the question is going to be, can the Fermi temperature be large enough that when the gap is suppressed with respect to the Fermi temperature, it can still be large enough to explain dark energy?
I'm glad you're asking that question, but I actually don't have, that's actually one of the problems in this mechanism.
That's going to be the crucial question.
That's right, and we don't have that result yet. Unfortunately, I have to work on this all by myself.
Can we just keep going and actually see the physics?
All right, so this is a basic assumption I'm making, that I want to covariantly couple gravity properly. These are free fermions. There's no interaction. And yes.
Attractive interaction will be gravity.
We'll see that in the next slide.
Okay.
And this is actually, this interaction is very nice, actually. So we have the connection. And what we do is we have to vary the action to get back this is Einstein-Clark entropy. We want to vary the action in respect to the virabind, tetrad virabind, and we will get the equivalent of the Einstein field equations. That's like varying with respect to the metric. We also have to vary with respect to the connection. When we vary with respect to the connection, we get the metric compatibility equation. So actually, we are going to be working with something called the Hulse action. The Hulse action is the Einstein-Cartan theory, or Palatini action, with this topological term. This term has no consequences because of the Bianchi identities. This is the dual of R. On the equations of motion, but it has consequences on the fermion interaction that we will get from solving the field equations. So the recipe here is we're going to solve for this connection. Okay, we solve for the connection to satisfy the metric compatibility tensor. The way to solve it was done by Laurent Rovelli and Perez, and actually by Wheeler. Wheeler did this also. He wrote a paper on neutrinos and gravity, okay, back in the 60s. Okay, and he actually speculated a little bit about that neutrinos could play a role in cosmology because of this interaction. Okay, so if you do that, there's an easy way to do this calculation. If you introduce this projection matrix here, all that really does, it allows me to rewrite things in the ordinary Palatini form. Okay, so I can take that dual piece and just include it in this projection matrix. And if I vary this action with respect to the connection, I get my metric compatibility equation. When this is zero, I get an equation that makes the connection metric compatible. So I get back the Christoffel symbol. Okay? So when this is zero. But notice when I vary this thing with respect to A, with fermions present, here, A is sitting in the interaction thing. So I'm going to pull out on the right-hand side a fermion bilinear. Okay, so I can actually solve for the full connection by using this ansatz. This is the metric compatible part. Right? This is the symmetric part of the connection, which is a Christoffel connection. And this is a contorsion tensor. And if I plug that ansatz in here, and I have on the right-hand side psi bar gamma mu, then I get the solution for this connection. I get the metric compatible part, which is in terms of derivatives of the Vierbein, and I get that this thing is J mu. Okay? Okay? And the nice thing about it is that this connection, this torsion tensor, okay, is not propagating torsion. It is a difference, actually, when the cute thing I learned here, that I learned a long time from you that the anti-symmetric free form, okay, which is the dual of the axion field in n is equal to 1 supergravity, is torsion, but it's propagating torsion because it's massless. In this case, I have torsion, but it's not propagating. That means it has no kinetic term, and that means I can plug it back into the action. And if I do that, so I solve for this contorsion tensor, and I get that it's proportional to this thing called the Ermitzi parameter, okay, and G Newton. And it's proportional to the fermion current, okay, and just from solving this equation, using that ansatz for the connection. If I do that, then I get my four fermion interaction, and Michael, cap this K has a minus sign in front of it. So it's an attractive interaction. General relativity has an attractive interaction, and it is, you know, it won't suffer from the usual loop problems if I had a kinetic term in that gauge field.
Dimension 8.
Dimension 6.
Excellent. But it's still got a G in front of it.
It's got a G in front of it, and then, yes, you better.
But there's this parameter again.
That's right. So I want to use some idea that you can renormalize this thing and lead you, but I don't have an answer for that. I know where you're going with it. So the point here is that we have the major condition for BCS theory that did not exist in the electroweak theory. You see, the electroweak theory, the neutrinos, which is the guys I'm going to use here, the neutrinos, the neutrinos have a four fermion interaction from a Z exchange, but it's repulsive. We're going to have to worry about that. But to my knowledge, this is the only interaction that is natural in general relativity. If you have fermions coupled into gravity, where you have an attractive interaction, and it doesn't depend on fluctuations of the metric, it's coming from this extra piece of the connection. Okay, so that's my lesson. And so all I now need is a Fermi surface. All of them. All the rock fermions.
But it's not measurable because chiral currents are microscopic. So it's only the neutrinos.
Exactly. Oh, good. You helped solve my problem. Now what we want to do, we want to quantize this fermion thing. We want to use the techniques. Basically, we'll do this with a path integral. But we want to make sure that we quantize the fermions consistently. What I mean by that, I want to make sure that I solve the field equations. I'm going to do cosmology. I want to solve the fermionic field equation self-consistently and then quantize. So to do that properly, I go back to the standard coupling of fermions in the FRW background, and this becomes my Dirac equation for the fermions in the background. And then I Fourier transform properly by, so I break my fermions up into a vial decomposition, and then I Fourier transform by redefining the phase by the scale factor. And that's a standard result in cosmology. You get it from Burrell and Davies. And what happens is that the fermionic system becomes equivalent to that of Minkowski space. Okay? But you have to be careful about how it shows up in a Fourier transform. So you can do that, and then the Dirac action becomes this in Fourier space. And then, screwed up here. Hold on a second. Yeah. And then you use a Fierce identity by realizing that this interaction can be split up into these three terms here. Now what we're going to do is we're going to focus on this term. In this term, I'm going to leave this up for some future work with Naraj. Okay, so I'm going to ignore this Lorentz violating term right now. but I'll get back to it later on. Yeah.
It's a question we'll get to this. But the same math works out.
So the standard way to do this is spelled out in a nice paper called Emergent Gauge Boson by B.J. Bjorken, where, and I guess it's a standard result, where you can, because you know that the functional, that a fermion bilinear, okay, can actually, you can do a functional integral for that, because it's just a determinant of that, of the, of that matrix. So what you can do here is you can complete the squares by introducing some auxiliary field, which becomes a gap, and find the effective potential for that thing. Now, I can do this because my torsion term is not propagating. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Do you have radii in the neutrinos?
No. I have a Dirac term, so I have.
So you have radii in the neutrinos in the theory.
Yeah.
And your ansatz is that it's the new left, new right, side by side that gets it there.
Yes.
And
but Dirac.
Dirac
mass.
Yeah, that's right. And
I want to keep away from I want to keep away from Majorana mass because I honestly don't know what to do with it.
Right.
I'm worried about things like these flavor change and violation things. I'm worried about that, so I kept away from it. But I would like to understand it, if you can tell me.
So the Majorana neutrino is its own antiparty.
I know, but there are these.
You don't want them.
Well, I don't know if I don't. I mean, I just don't know.
You don't want it, but I want it. But you want it, but I don't want it. But that's not this problem to do it this way. So it's interesting.
We don't know whether neutrino is Majorana or Dirac. Yet.
Fine.
Well, that's experiments, a double baby K that would be that, nice to see, but
that should answer the problem.
I don't know that I could understand the textbook when I read it. I have many regrets. There are certain things I felt I should have learned before I left my postdoc.
It's like it's too late now.
You can teach them.
All right, so
what I just want to spell out here is the name of the game here is to calculate this, the determinant of this guy here. All right, that is just coming from here. I should have an equation for that. Yeah, good. So, in other words, the way to get the effective potential is to compute this guy with the gap measure and the fermionic measure, and once you use this this as my effective action, then it turns out you can perform this integral by computing the determinant of this matrix, and so you go ahead and you end up computing this thing here. This leads naturally to the effective potential. Okay?
So we're using
a standard treatment in Peskin and Schroeder and other good books of how to calculate this, the effective one loop potential, okay, for this fermion. It is.
Where is it? Where does it come from? The fermion?
It comes from this.
Okay. So that last term.
There's a chemical potential, and so either my fermions are finite number density; they're not in vacuum. That's an assumption. Okay. It's an assumption. I don't know why I get it from leptogenesis. I have an early universe with a lot of fermions, and they're free. They're interacting by this gravitational four-point interaction. And I put it in by hand. So then
I get this effective potential. But in this case, the energy density, okay, is V plus mu n. Now, in the Maven models, they put it in by hand classically, and that's exactly the term they have. But I get it naturally from the quantum treatment. All right, so now we're cooking. Now we have our effective potential. Now, for those of you who like scalar fields, think of this as phi squared. So we have naturally a phi to the fourth term that you would get, okay, in ordinary scalar field theories. This is very similar to Coleman-Weinberg, okay? Except you have an extra term here, which is important for what I'm going to show you. So this is like phi squared, then we have a log of phi squared, and then we have the energy density depends on mu. So we have an equation for the gap. We have an algebraic equation. Okay.
Yeah, because log of delta squared is going to be really small. So the logarithm is negative.
Oh, is that how it works?
Right. So that's going to be the dominant term?
That will be the dominant term at late times. So that's right. We have to minimize this potential and solve the gap equation. That's how. The way the gap equation shows up here is by minimizing the potential. The way it shows up in Feynman diagrams is that you sum over all the loops.
And I'm just confused. Yeah. The chemical potential is that there's a net number of neutrinos, right?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
You're fixing the number of neutrinos, like.
So you need a large number of neutrinos in the universe.
Yes, you do. You need a larger than usual leptogenesis energy.
That's right.
And I don't know where
there comes. Have to be lots of red-handed neutrinos as well, I guess.
Yes.
And they came from somewhere, and you assume that's.
I did. Then that's my assumption.
Yeah.
So that's my only assumption here.
What is capital N? Capital N?
Oh no, I was hoping you wouldn't ask that question. All right, so.
Actually, can we go back?
Let me first answer Neil's question. So this is a dimension 6 operator, so it's not renormalizable. And we don't know what the heck to do with it. But what we did do is that we actually did regulate it properly. We used dimensional regularization. And as a result, we end up with a cutoff scale in the theory. And in that case, what N is the following. Our F of Janka M Planck times e to the minus n over 2. So our cutoff procedure is what we call M star. And M star times delta squared is a mass term of the gap.
So that's the definition of N.
That's the definition of N.
Gravity,
has to do with the cutoff. You have the dimensional regularization scheme.
You have gravity in there, which is not renormalized.
So yeah, gravity is not renormalized.
Why are you worried about this point?
Because I would like to understand it.
No, I know, but
I don't understand it.
This should not be a problem at the moment.
All right, so I know I'm running out of time, but I started 10 minutes. Because the talk gets much interesting. This is the hard stuff, and I want to get us through this hard stuff. All right, so I hope I make Neil happy here that you have to. So there is a problem, I think, here, which is that I have this very. This has to end up being. I think I'm digging myself in a hole here. This is going to end up being an milli-electron volt scale mass. So I have to really renormalize this Hermitian parameter. Okay? But I leave it up for you guys to do that.
The parameter is totally free. There's absolutely no experimental constraint on what its value is at this stage.
Okay, so then I can resort to you and you can roll the sleeve and fight for me. Okay, so Lee, you got it? Okay, so this is the potential we're going to deal with, energy density. And now, I'm going to because I quantize, see the nice thing about this, because I quantize these fermions self-consistently, then I'm really looking at the Einstein equation here, okay, with the fermions, properly. So the reason why I really want to stress this is that you won't get the effect if you didn't quantize the fermions properly. We tried it before, and we quantized the fermions in a Minkowski background and plugged it into the Friedman equation, and we got nothing interesting. So it really was important to actually do that properly. And thanks to My collaborators are able to do that. And then we have a nice relationship between the number density and the gap. So we're going to use that, okay? Because we want to solve the system. We have three equations. We have two algebraic equations, which is this tie between the number density and the gap. And we have the gap equation, which ties in the mass of the gap, okay, and the number density, which I'm not showing you here. So and then we have the frequency.
N is the number density of neutrinos.
Yes.
And so Neil is just mumbling in my ear that that's mass. When the universe expands, that gets smaller.
It does.
And you're taking that into account?
It is taking that into account. And that's not, you know, this intuition is good. How? That's it. We'll see it.
Oh, I see. It's huge.
Yeah, it's a huge unit. Okay. So, in fact, and that's actually, you see, we didn't have the kind of intuition when we were doing this. So we just did it on a computer. We're like, it makes sense. It does tie in. And we want it to dive in.
Okay, so let's see here.
All right. Now, what we are going to look at is this parameter here. All right? We're going to look at this. We want to see the late times, whether or not this tends to minus 1. That's the name of the game.
But it should go to 0, I guess, this time. You mean you want
to play? To 1. All right, so, sorry, if E is less than 1, okay, you got acceleration, right? Mm-hmm. That's the acceleration parameter. All right, so you could look at the analytic treatment of this in two different regimes. At early times, what you find is that, and don't jump on me for this, Neil, but you get something like negative radiation. But that's fine. I mean, you guys need that in your bouncing situation anyway, so. Okay, and it does. The gap actually does fall at 1 over a at early times. And at late times, it goes as 1 over a cubed.
Sorry, I'm really confused now.
Okay, fine.
So there should be a gap equation somewhere.
There is a gap equation, and I didn't show it to you. But let me see if I could.
I think you did.
I did?
So the gap equation should be something like delta squared is equal to delta squared times. It should have delta squared on both sides.
That's right. And it does.
The gap equation, just for me, for us, unexperts, is the equation that specifies the minimum of this potential.
But you did have that. The question that gives you n, that's the gap equation, right?
This is let me just write the gap equation and make Michael happy. So the gap equation is m squared is equal to delta squared n plus 1 2 mu squared n plus 2 plus delta squared minus 2 mu squared log of delta squared. And when delta is much less than...
And m squared on the left-hand side is related to delta.
That's right.
What is m squared?
Yeah.
So you can solve for delta when delta goes when m is constant and mu, the chemical potential,
right,
is much less than delta, you get the exponential solution that you can check to see that delta goes as e to the minus 1 over mu, I believe, m.
Sorry, m is related to this other m star or?
Yes, yeah, this is m star.
So that should be proportional to delta squared.
That should be proportional to delta squared.
I'm really lost.
So this log term,
m star. No, a priori, m star should be proportional to delta squared.
In the regime where delta, when the chemical potential is much less than delta.
No, because m is set.
Right, so the gap equation in general is this transcendental equation.
Always, m delta has to be much less than mu, right?
Yes. Not at early times.
Not at early times.
No.
Oh, but at early times, the density is huge because the universe hasn't expanded.
Yes.
But nevertheless, you say at early times there's a different solution. There's only later you go to the.
Yeah, I go to this. Delta is roughly a constant solution at late times.
So in that regime, it should be like m star squared is equal to a constant times delta squared.
Absolutely, in that regime.
Can you write that equation? Because you're going to solve this for delta, right?
I'm going to solve this for delta. Can I call it c times delta?
Yeah. And then you plug that in up top and you solve it for delta.
Yes.
So, but mu is changing dramatically as the universe expands.
Yes.
So, so delta isn't constant.
It isn't constant, and I'm showing what the solutions are. Yeah, so, so can I show you the numerical solutions, because we did it all properly, because it's a transcendental equation. So this is the full late time acceleration. We use Mathematica to do this.
Oh, I'm sorry. Slowly, it's
good. So, this is the evolution of the scale factor. And then we have the evolution of the slow roll parameter
for the scale factor, and the evolution of Hubble. Okay, so the following behavior is the scale factor grows linearly as we expect, and then we do see some late time acceleration in the scale factor. The slow roll parameter generically, again, for a wide range of n's, okay, that Neil points out, which is an important thing here. This n, if you look in our paper, we look at a parameter, we parameterize solutions in terms of different values of n. And the nice thing is that n chosen that this m star is the milli electron volt scale gives you the late time acceleration. All right, so there's a coincidence with the scales, all right, that you get late time acceleration when n is roughly 100 and something, whatever. So you get m Lachung. So there's a nice rescaling of m Planck. It's from the cutoff. A UV cutoff. It's a UV cutoff.
A UV cutoff well below the Planck scale.
Yes, absolutely. And the Hubble parameter. Does this thing. But the important thing is that we do get this fixed late time acceleration, okay, independent of a lot of the parameters here.
What I was asking for, delta over mu. That's a
function. I have it here. That's too good.
What was the other graph you had?
Yes, so the mu and the delta. I'll have to dig up your talk, but let me tell you what they do. So delta mu, okay, grows in time.
Mu was negative, but goes to zero. I don't know if that's true, but it's negative.
Yeah, it goes to zero. This is zero, and it's negative because it's an attractive interaction.
Sorry, I thought mu is the chemical potential.
Yeah, mu is the chemical potential.
Is that positive for Fermi gas?
No, in this case it's negative.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So how can you say there's a Fermi surface if mu is negative?
I'm sorry. No, let me. So this is a recurve. Mu is positive, but the interaction. Remember, the interaction is negative.
No, I just asked about mu.
No, mu is positive.
Mu is positive.
Mu is positive. I know, that's because we, okay. There's overall normalization.
Okay. It's got to be that mu is positive and goes to zero as the universe expands.
Yes, so that's what I'm showing you. It's,
oh.
Yeah, let me, so this was minus, it basically positive.
It's the upside down.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Okay.
So now, what about delta?
Delta does this. Delta starts off large and increases to a constant, tensor constant. So in this regime, it goes as 1 over 8 to the 4. And in this regime, some intermediate regime,
right,
it goes to matter domination like this, and then it goes to a constant at late times, generically. Okay.
So at the late time value is that delta is much larger than mu.
Yes.
OK. So that's a mystery that we have to talk about.
OK, you seem to have. OK, good. But I mean, this is what the equations are telling me.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so the upshot of this is the following. Let's redo this in terms of the equation of state prime. So I can just take everything and use a Rauch-Dyrer equation and just do everything in terms of the equation of state parameter. And what we see is the following. You have a generically an early period of phantom energy domination. All right? You can't do anything about it. You have an equation of state at early times as much that's less than one, but you know, doesn't, again, we deal with values of the scale factor where we trust the effective field theory. Okay?
The effective W less than minus one temporarily.
Right. But it always goes to minus, it always tends to minus one.
Yeah.
Always. It's at a fixed point, a tractor, and no matter what we do to our equations with parameters, it always goes to minus one. So the upshot of the story is, if you believe what I told you about the genericity of the four fermion interaction in general relativity, and you believe that there's a finite number density, the fermions, and you believe my equations, then this is the solution, that you always get some long-range correlation, okay, some strongly correlated Fermi gas that naturally has late-time acceleration. But so what? I mean, it's just now it's one of another model for dark energy. We have modified gravity. Actually, I like this model because it's both modified gravity and
adding something new with a degree of freedom.
Because we have to talk about this extra four fermion term that's gravitationally induced, so it's a modified gravity in that sense. But actually, we are doing something interesting with neutrinos. Okay.
Did you calculate the equation of state?
That was the equation of state theory.
Yeah, but did you just calculate it directly?
In other words, yeah, we didn't calculate it. We didn't calculate the equation.
You don't need the GR to, if you have the effective potential. And
yeah, we can we bypass it, but we would like to do it that way too.
So you haven't done that?
No, we haven't done it. We would like to do it.
I mean, just naively, why is the, you're getting pressures that are huge and negative out of this cloud of fermions with a small interaction. Why are they not anything like matter?
I need to think about that. It's a hard question.
Well, I think the problem is that when you go up to the UV scale, interaction is the small end.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to look carefully at how the theory is being implemented.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the Achilles heel. We just don't know what to do with the field theory of the UV scale.
So if it were true that delta were always much less than mu, you could dispense with that problem, but it's not. So.
When is it avoided, you? I forgot.
Sorry?
When is delta avoided?
At late.
At late.
Yes, at late time, delta is avoided. Yeah.
So that is going into the regime where you're not sure about that.
That's right.
Now, I want to use the last 5 minutes to talk about how you consistently get neutrino oscillations from this picture.
But Mike, let's pay very. This is to me the nicest part of this work. Let's go back and now introduce three flavors of fermions into the gravitational action. When we solve the metricity condition, we now have to introduce. Oh, I screwed up. There should be a B here. B corresponds to the number of flavors. Okay. So now I take that and I plug it back into my four fermion term by solving for the step I showed you. Now I end up with an operator like this, where I have A and B.
There's a sum over A and B. This is Einstein's summation.
In the top one, there's a sum over B.
There's a sum over B here.
And C is the total torsion.
C is the total torsion. Right? Follow this note very carefully. Now, this is the upshot of the talk. It is not, the question is, what is this condensate?
Let's go back to QCD, our friends Wilczek and Rajagopal, where they consider the breaking of the flavor and the color. You have the glass condensate regime. So you have a diagonal, you break to a diagonal SU2, which now includes a condensate of a flavor neutrino with a colored neutrino. similar thing is happening here naturally. Because once I use a Fields transformation, what happens is that this A, B thing here, if I were to naively give this a verb, I would not get what I'm gonna, I wouldn't get oscillations. But general relativity is clever, because if I use Fields transformation, I get now the A's and B's get reshuffled. So I get A, B, and it decomposes into four fermion with gamma phi and four fermion with gamma I. Gamma I is SC2. Okay? Now that's an important step. And it's just an identity. So if I go back and if I redo my computation, then I get an effective Lagrangian for my neutrinos. And here it is. I have a CPT violating term, which I'll get back to in a second, about the neutrinos interacting with the gap. So now I'm looking at the propagating neutrinos in its own condensate. I get this from the effective action that I quantized originally. And then I get this term here. This term is exactly a Dirac mass term, but the Dirac mass, and there's a gamma 5 here. Okay. I call this thing M delta. So I naturally get a Dirac mass term, but remember, this condensate is a flavored condensate. What is it? So an electron neutrino, for example, pairs up with a muon neutrino. Okay, that's the idea. A neutrino propagates in that background, and the question is, what happens to this neutrino? So now I want to look at this, the Dirac equation for a neutrino and an antineutrino. Okay, but
there's some verb of nu bar A, nu B.
I didn't assume it. I mean,
you derive it.
Right? I derived it, yeah.
Right. So because you derived it, there must be a reason why it's off the egg.
Well, the claim I'm trying to make here is that the minute you introduce n flavors of fermions and it interacts with the gravitational field, okay, the gravitational field mixes it generically.
Can you write down the blackboard equation?
Which one?
An empty blackboard.
which equation?
The problem
wasn't the
blackboard.
The expectation value of mu bar A, mu B,
okay,
is equal to a constant times delta, an ordinary delta.
Yeah.
Chronic delta. Okay. So this is a particular solution that I might suggest to your equation.
Okay.
You claim that there's a more general solution, where instead of delta AB, I have a general matrix, capital delta AB.
Okay, that's an assumption.
Okay. So, but you should solve the equation, right? So the equation will tell you which one is the middle.
I didn't solve that equation. That's the next paper. Okay. This paper was to point out that if it is a solution, but that, the reason why is because I got scooped last week.
Okay.
So, I think
you go back to the, isn't it your argument to say that from the point of view of gravity, A and B are,
well, I mean,
they mix A and B and you would get, so if it's diagonal,
you're
it's
telling like, me that this should be a, I mean, I'm just using this identity. Yeah.
Right, so now when you solve the gap equation, you're going to put in the verbs for the bilinears.
Yes.
And so,
I know what it is. This is the ansatz that I use.
This question is which set of verbs optimizes them?
Okay, let me tell you what my ansatz and the dream is. It's lambda AB delta. And this is a coupling, matrix.
Yes.
That's the assumption I'm making.
Okay. And then
I don't know what this coupling constant is.
And then you solve for that's the next one.
Yeah, and then I already know the solution for this from previous treatments, but now I'm assuming that there's a coupling matrix and I don't know what it is.
Okay.
And I'm going to constrain that with data.
Okay. So and good. And then if that thing's off diagonally, the data.
If it's off diagonal, then I'm in business. Right. And in fact, let me show you what that is. So the standard thing that we do with neutrino oscillations is the following: we have the mass eigenstates, and we recognize that the mass eigenstates. What we should look at is in the physical, the flavor eigenstates. And you can get from one to the other by a unitary rotation. In the case of two flavors, I have an SU2 matrix, okay? This is a so-called mass matrix. So
And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to only consider two flavors of neutrinos here. I'm actually glad Jim is here, because a long time ago, Jim and Cliff Burgess wrote a very nice paper that I would like to understand, if you have Majorana neutrinos. This is very similar to the Majoran models, but it's not a fundamental scalar field. So what we want to do now is solve the Dirac equation in the presence of these new terms in the flavor eigenstates. So what we have to do is rotate the Dirac equation. All right, our Dirac equation is in the mass eigenstates with n for two flavors. We're going to rotate the Dirac equation into the mass eigenstate and solve for the probability of one neutrino becoming the other. And the way we do that, standard thing is that we consider propagating states, okay, that are rotated into the flavor space from the mass eigenspace. And then what we do is we do an ultra-relativistic approximation, which tells us that the waveform p mu x mu, all right, if you just do this ultra-relativistic approximation, then this basically becomes this for a neutrino moving in the z direction. And we end up with the standard scaling of the neutrino at a given energy observed over a given length. So what we want to do is measure how a neutrino oscillates from one flavor to the other over a given length detected at a given energy. And so that's what this L over E is. And that's a standard thing. And if you do that, and you look at my paper or, you know, Rahman's book on neutrinos, a great book, Physics Beyond the Standard Model, you will get that the Dirac equation in the flavor basis has the following two things. And this is the upshot of my talk. If there's anything to take away, is the following. You get the standard oscillation. You get the standard oscillation, again, without the seesaw mechanism, all right, if you have an off-diagonal coupling matrix. And that's an assumption, but I'm assuming it. But if you have that, but what is this delta M? This is nothing more than a dark energy density. It's delta. So the thing I showed you before that led to late time acceleration.
Okay,
I have one more transparency. But the important thing here is that you cannot have this without this. The CPT violated terms leads to a new oscillation
Well, you can if the bev is diagonal.
Okay, you can if it's diagonal.
Okay, so we need to find that out.
We need to find out.
If the bev is off diagonal, you guys.
If the bev is off diagonal, we have this term here, and this is a new oscillation that the traditional seesaw mechanism doesn't have, which tells you that, so what I'm, the probability now not only depends on delta M over 2E neutrino. That's a standard result for atmosphere and solar neutrinos. That's what's been measured. And what I'm saying, you can get this number if you know this equation of state. So we have a way of tying now the equation of state parameter with neutrino oscillations. But on top of that, we have oscillations that also depend on the CPT violating term. And that was recently, 2 weeks ago, studied the phenomenology of that by Kamenkowski, Mikulchik, and Ando. So my paper is not about looking at the phenomenology, but to point out that my model predicts it, if you have whatever. So let me conclude. So the dark energy problem requires new physics, you know that, and my idea is that you can get a gravitationally induced BCS condensate, and we can get a connection if certain assumptions are made, but the upshot is that we might be able to actually constrain this prediction. Thank you.
So there have been lots of questions.
So there's another group that wants to make a comment.
No, it's another talk. Group, but it's a different talk. So let's see. So
I suggest we go to the next talk. And Stefan is here through tomorrow. I mean, there's a lot to say, and we've had a lot of discussion. Yeah.